The following is an encore episode of Hour One of the Turley Frequency with host Kevin Turley. We hope you enjoy.
Yes, indeed. Happy days are here again. It's Monday. Monday, the best day of the week, no? What? It's not?
It is, Kevin. It
of
is.
Of course this, it is.
It's a happy day, too, because I wanted to get this out. I didn't mention this in our previous hour with L.A. Catholic Morning, but it's my son Donnie, his 12th birthday. So I want to wish him and ask all of our listeners to join in and pray in a special prayer for him and this this 21st of November.
Is Donnie at school at the moment?
He is not at school at the moment. He's with everybody else. All the other kids are out of school on this Thanksgiving week.
Let's get him on the phone.
I'll try to get him on the phone.
See if he wants to come on. I want to talk to him.
Okay, I will.
But happy days are here again. It's Monday, and I want to know why you don't love Monday. I love Mondays. It's the start of the week, start of the working week. Don't you jump out of bed on a Monday morning and punch the air and say, yes, another working week. Another week of colleagues and telephone calls and emails and Facebook notes and messages and WhatsApp and Skype. Don't you just love it? What? You don't? Come on. Come on. Now, listen, how'd you get on with the Sabbath switch off yesterday? Do you remember on Friday we were talking about how to live Sundays better? Do you remember? Well, if you've forgotten, that's what we were talking about. And I wondered how you got on. I was thinking about it yesterday. You know, it was a day when you just switch off. You switch off your phone, you switch off your email, you switch off your internet, except if you maybe want to watch a film together as a family or something. And you just stop thinking about work. You stop mentally preparing for it. You stop worrying about it, thinking about it, things going over in your mind. You just switch off. But you don't just switch off like a vegetable. No, 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 no. You switch on to the Lord and what his plan is for you this week. So welcome to the Turley Frequency here on Archangel Radio. Coming to you on 1410 AM, 94.5 FM, and on the Archangel app. And through the wonders of the internet across the globe, you can listen anywhere. You can be in Tajikistan today listening to this program. Outer Mongolia, Papua New Guinea, doesn't matter where you are, you can have the same program brought to your radio ears, and you're all very welcome. So yesterday was Sunday, so those of us that are Catholics, we trooped off to Mass gladly and joyfully. That's the high point of the week, really, because Sunday's the first day of the week, and Sunday Mass is the high point of the week, which got me thinking. I don't know about you. I was taught by priests, and you know, they used to teach you religion back in those days, and they'd sort of have you in the classroom, and they'd ask you questions. You know, they'd ask the class questions just to see how ignorant we were really about matters of the faith, I think. Anyway, one day the priest was at the front, and he said, he was talking about Sunday, and you know the way they've just reinstated this Sunday obligation in this country, so that you have to go to Mass on Sundays. During the pandemic and the lockdown, you know, there was, you know, things were liberalized. You didn't have to go. You could go online. And then there was a period where some people were going in person, some people were going online, et cetera. Do you remember? And then recently they've said, no, everybody's back. You know, we had a parish survey, parish census a few weeks ago, and the parish priest said to me, we're at least 25% down on pre-pandemic rates, which is quite sad, really. I mean, some of those will be, unfortunately, people who have died during the pandemic and people who just would have died anyway, elderly people who are the bulk of the parish, let's be honest. But it was sad that we've lost sort of 20, we're missing in action 25% of our fellow parishioners. So we need to try to help people to get back to Mass. But anyway, back to this classroom many, many years ago. And the priest was saying, right, to fulfill your Sunday obligation, to fulfill your Sunday obligation, at what point do you have to get to Sunday Mass? Now, of course, we were all dragooned to Sunday Mass by our parents. So, I mean, it didn't make any difference to us. We always seemed to be there hours before Mass and, you know, it didn't matter. So we were all scratching our heads and the priest was looking around. And I used to enjoy it when the priest would pick somebody out and ask them the question, as long as it wasn't me. But that day, the priest pointed me and said, you, Turley, at what point can you come into Mass and still fulfill your Sunday obligation? So listen, I was thinking on my feet, right? You know, I mean, what do you say? So I said, well, Father, I think as long as you're there before the collection plate's taken up, you're okay. And needless to say, it wasn't the right answer. Maybe it was the right answer in some parishes, but it wasn't the right answer. No, it's not about getting your money on the collection plate. That's as important as that is. If there's anybody listening who's a priest, let us know what that obligation is. I will look it up for you. But if there's anybody out there who would like to phone in and tell me, at what point do you fulfill your Sunday obligation by turning up? What's the latest you can do? Is it before the gospel, after the gospel, before the creed, or before the collection plate? Call us on 1-888-928-0881 or text us on 251-928-2111. Always glad of your input. Which reminds me, I don't know about you, but over here, after the pandemic, and the lockdown and the closing of churches, the emails we got from our local parishes were asking us to go online and set up standing orders, you know, get the bank to pay a monthly amount to the parish. Because up until then, most people in parishes, certainly this side of the Atlantic, would throw a few dollars, a few pounds onto the collection plate. That was the way in which we sustained our local parishes. And, you know, I can remember when those collections were mainly jingle jangle affairs because it was mostly, you know, well, it would be in your currency, dimes and quarters and cents and pennies would be thrown on the collection plate. And then as things progressed over the years, the collection would become silent. It'd be almost a silent collection moving around as £5, £10, $5, $10, $20, whatever it was in your currency, were thrown into the basket or the plate, whatever was the mechanism by which the money was collected. But then after the lockdown and after the pandemic, we were all encouraged to pay via card. You know, by credit card, debit card, in these kind of machines at the back of the church. They suddenly all popped up about a year ago. And I could see sort of older members of the congregation looking at these things as if they just landed from a space machine or something. You know, what is this at the back of the church? And they were just like anything you'd get in a supermarket or whatever. You could actually just click an amount, touch it with your card, bingo. Done, right? So it made sense. Now, you know, some people might say, well, it's this move towards a cashless society and all the rest of it. That's for another day, another debate. It was quite handy because I don't know about you, but increasingly I was not carrying a lot of cash around, you know, and I'd always forget to have any on me on a Sunday. So it was always handy. If you had a card, you could take it. Anyway,
so, Kevin, day, hey, speaking of cash, somebody who probably got some cash for his birthday is my son, Donnie. So whose birthday is today. So I'll let you wish him a happy birthday.
Donnie, is it Donnie on the line?
Say yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Donnie Romano, it's an honor and a privilege to speak to you on this great day.
Thank you.
I wish you many, many happy returns. How old are you today, Donnie?
12.
12? That's a good age, you know. 12 is a good age.
Amen. We're so blessed that he came into to our world and he's our first child. He made us parents, and Donnie loves to cook. So he'll have to send you some of his. He likes to cook ribs, so he'll have to send you some ribs to the UK.
It might be a bit cold by the time they get here, Donnie. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I think so.
So, Donnie, tell me what are you doing today on your birthday? And you're lucky. You got a day off school, right?
Yeah. Well, no, I'm homeschooled. So.
Oh, you're homeschooled anyway, so that's so good. But listen, what's the plan today? What's the way in which we celebrate 12 years of this wondrous life of Donnie Romano?
Oh, we go to Owa.
Owa, he doesn't know what Owa is. It's an amusement park in Foley, Alabama.
And what is there, Donnie? What sort of amusements do they have?
Water park and roller coasters.
You like roller coasters?
Some roller coasters, not all.
You and me both. It's been a while since I've been on a roller coaster. It doesn't really appeal to me being shaken around like that. Do you know what I mean? Sort of going up and down and my stomach going up and coming down. I mean, I could just go on the London Underground. I get that experience most days. So, Donnie, what are you going to have? What's on the menu tonight? Do you have a special meal tonight because it's Donnie's birthday?
I do not know.
Oh, it's a surprise. Is Jennifer cooking something special, Mike?
I think we will, or we may go out. I know last year Donnie made ribs for his own parties. But his ribs are phenomenal. We just got him a new smoker for his birthday, and he smoked some ribs on Friday night, and they were incredible. The best ribs I've ever had in my life. So
Donnie, tell me, what's the secret of really good ribs? Come on, give us a secret sauce.
Cook them low and slow. Low
and slow.
And tell can you tell them what you put on it, or is that going to be a secret? Is that a secret recipe? Tell them what you put on your ribs.
You'd have to kill me if you told me, man.
That's not a secret recipe.
What is it, Donnie? Tell the nation. Tell the whole of Southern Alabama.
It's Max's meat rub from Food Network.
Ooh. Yeah. You recommend that?
I highly recommend it. Tell him what he puts on it.
He puts coconut sugars, kosher salt. I add brown sugar to the mix.
Do you?
Paprika. I think there's two other pepper. There's regular pepper and one more other pepper.
Sounds great. What do you have for pudding then, Donnie? What's your signature dish when it comes to desserts?
Probably cake.
Just straight old cake. Any particular type of cake? Chocolate cake? Sponge cake? What sort of cake, Jill?
Carrot.
Which one? Carrot cake.
Carrot.
Oh, nice. I like carrot cake. Trouble is, do you not find carrot cake a bit dry? You need something with it, don't you? Something to drink?
Yes, you need something to drink with every. They're all dry.
That's true. That is true. So, what are you going to be drinking tonight? What's your favorite beverage?
Oh, sweet tea.
Sweet tea.
That's a common beverage here in the South, Kevin.
Yeah, we don't like it hot like you guys. We like it like cold.
Oh, you have iced tea, isn't it? You have iced tea.
Yeah.
Yes, nice. Yeah, well, look, if you had the same weather as we have, I'm just looking at it, it's pouring down and it's cold, you might want a cup of tea, a hot cup of tea, just to warm you up. We say to warm you up, you know, it gives you courage to keep going. But it sounds like this is a great day. Donnie, do you look forward to your birthdays?
Yeah.
You do. You're lucky, you know. My birthday is very close to Christmas, so it always gets overlooked. Always gets overlooked. Except by my nearest and dearest. So having a birthday in November is quite a nice time, especially near Thanksgiving. No, you sort of have a big celebration, then you have Thanksgiving. The whole week is a kind of Donnie celebration, isn't it?
Yeah.
And does your father and mother put the flags out when it's your birthday?
We do.
Come on, Mike.
Not a flag. We put a banner. We put a banner out.
Well, listen, I think it should not just a banner. It should be a band out front playing Welcome Home. Happy days are here again, Donnie, no?
Yeah.
Listen, Donnie, as you're my first birthday caller, Can I ask that every year that you have a birthday at this time and I'm on air, you'd come on air and tell us what you're doing?
Sure.
That's if the show lasts a whole year. I mean, we might be off the air by next month, but if you're around and I'm around, phone in and tell me all about what you're up to. 12's a good age. Are you going to watch a movie tonight together as a family to celebrate?
No, I don't like movies.
You don't like movies?
No.
Oh, wow. You're watching the wrong movies. That's what it is. Haven't you seen any of the films I'm in? Yeah, best not to watch those. Okay, Donnie. Well, listen, have a great day. And I really hope that you and your family have a great celebration. We got that great news from your dad on Friday, live on air. So, listen, it's a wonderful time to be in the Romano household. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes.
Good. Okay. Listen, stay tuned to Archangel, and we'll talk again this time next year, okay, Donnie? If not before.
Okay.
All right. Have a great day. Happy birthday, Donnie.
Thank you. Bye.
No, thank you. Listen, anybody else out there having a birthday, phone in 888-928-0881 or text me on 251-928-2111. And, of course, Donnie will be prayed for at the top of the hour when we do the Divine Mercy Chaplet. And you're all invited to join in on that. And that is a prayer for the living and the dead, for any problems you may be having today, this Monday. But we're celebrating Monday today. We're celebrating the joys of being alive. Now, I was telling you about the machines at the back of the church. Do you remember? Well, that's what I was talking about. So back of the church, the machines. So, you know, it was quite convenient, you know, not having any cash to go and tap in, tap out with whatever. So the other day I went up to it to try to pay very large amount, but a large amount, because I hadn't had my card on me for weeks. So I was in arrears, so to speak. And you don't want to be in arrears with heaven, right? So I was thinking, well, I need to make a major donation here to get up to speed on my parish. And they need it, right? All hands on deck. You know, the workman deserves his wage, and the parishes don't thrive on thin air. They thrive on the pennies of all of us. So I tried, didn't work. Card failed, card denied, and I thought there was something wrong with my card. So I went to shops later and was in the store buying goods, and it worked fine. I thought, well, that's odd. Must be the machine. A couple of days later, I tried again. The machine didn't work again in the church. I thought, there's something wrong with this machine. Anyway, end of Mass the other day, a big sign up saying, out of order. Machine was out of order. And the priest was at the back of the church. You know, I don't know if you do this in the States, priest at the back of the church, the end of Mass, saying goodbye to everybody and hello to everybody and all the rest. So I went up to him and said, Father, I think I broke the machine. He said, what do you mean you think you broke the machine? I said, well, the other day I was trying to make quite a large donation to the parish, and I think, it couldn't cope. And the machine stopped. And he just looked at me, and he could tell straight away I wasn't really a big spender when it came to parish donations, I think. And he said, don't worry, Kevin, he said, it'll be fixed soon and you can try again with the same amount, which I thought was a good response, right? But on a serious note, last Sunday I took cash to church and I put it in the collection plate. And it kind of fitted with what we've been talking about in the show for the last few weeks about turning screens off and rejoicing in human contact. Now, I was looking at a number of headlines before I came on air today, and it looks like Facebook, Twitter, TikTok, they're all in free fall. They're all in free fall. They've all got problems. They've all got problems, mainly about how to make money, but there's other problems which are well attested to, and I'm sure you've heard on various other news outlets. And, you know, I can't help but think that's maybe not a bad thing. Maybe we're coming to the end of this social media tyranny that has ruled so many lives and blighted so many lives. You know, there was a survey done. Let me just find this. There was a survey done in 2022. It was done by a rather obscure group who published their findings in an even more obscure publication called the Cyber Psychology Behavior and Social Networking Magazine. Yeah, I know. Never heard of it. But its findings were this, in a nutshell. A control group had 1 week's break from social media. And guess what? In one week, their well-being improved. Their depression levels plummeted. Anxiety went away. Suddenly, they started feeling better after 1 week away from social media. So when I see the headlines that the social media giants are going down the pan, maybe not such a bad thing. We need to start talking to each other again. Talking of which, I'm going to be talking to a writer, a novelist in a few minutes' time, who, because of what we were talking about on Friday, is on the show today. But more of that after these words. Stay with me.
Paperback writer.
And you're back with me, Kevin Turley, here on the Turley Frequency, and we have a real live paperback writer, hardback and Kindle and all the rest, with us here today. Claire grew up in the United States, graduated from Harvard University with a degree in European history, and she's worked for many years as a newspaper reporter, later a magazine editor. She's also taught high school history and reviewed books for the Wall Street Journal, the Baltimore Sun, and all those good sort of papers. She's the mother of two grown-up children and lives with her husband in D.C. and also in New York. But why she's here today is because Claire has published a novel called A Most English Princess. Claire, welcome to the Turley Frequency.
So great to be here.
Now, you have come on this show because of what we were discussing on Friday. I'll just let everybody know. On Friday at story time, which is the last segment of this show, I talked about Grand Duchess Elizabeth of Hesse and her wonderful story, much acclaimed as the most beautiful woman in Europe at one point, and then she married into the Romanov dynasty. And she ended her days at the hands of the Bolshevik in a holy martyrdom. Anyway, listening to that show was a listener in Germany who happens to know you, Claire. And she said to me, you've got to speak to Claire because Claire, well, you tell them, Claire, what are you doing?
I'm following up my first novel, which was about a member of the British royal family, with a second novel about Ella, as she was known in the family, now a saint in the Orthodox Church.
That's right.
She was born Princess Elizabeth of Hesse and by Rhine, a small place in Germany.
That's right. But I mean, how did you come across her because you were of your first novel, which I'll just repeat the title, A Most English Princess. Is that because you were researching about the Victoria and the family and everything and you came across the sort of links with the Germans? Was that how it came about?
Yes, exactly. I'm a student, actually, of German history. And when I came to write a novel, I wanted to write a historical novel. And my eye fell upon a woman known to her family as Vicky. She was Queen Victoria's eldest daughter, and she was married off to a man named Fritz. Like so many German princes, his name was Fritz. He was the Crown Prince of Prussia, and she was sent to Prussia to marry him and bring British constitutional values to what was then a militaristic state in Prussia. She really failed in that grand mission. It was really out of her control. She did fall in love with her husband, Fritz, and she is best known really as the mother of Kaiser Wilhelm II. It's a fascinating story.
Which you probably know, and I alluded to it on Friday, Clara, that the future Kaiser Wilhelm at one point had romantic intentions towards Ella.
Exactly. So Kaiser Wilhelm, he had this English mother and he had a Prussian father, and his cousins lived in this little place called Darmstadt, about 300 miles from Berlin. Their mother was Alice, who is Vicky's younger sister, the second daughter of Queen Victoria. And Alice had married a German Grand Duke called Ludwig. and he's the Grand Duke of Hesse, and they together had 7 children. And Ella was the second. And as you noted, everyone noted meeting her, and historically, she was an extremely beautiful young girl and woman, and also had a wonderful nature. She was generous and kind, funny, and Wilhelm, who was a difficult personality from birth. He had people will remember, he had a lame arm.
That's right.
At the age of, from the age of 12 or 13, when he had his cousin Ella was 8 or 9 at this point, he said to people who, I'm going to marry my cousin Ella. Now, this would have been okay, probably, and it probably would have gone through, except for Vicky, Wilhelm's mother, was one of the people in the royal family most cognizant of recent scientific discoveries, which showed that hemophilia was a disease probably carried by the mother. Now we know this to be true. And she liked Ella, but she discouraged Wilhelm from marrying Ella because she had had a brother who died of hemophilia. And Vicky in general thought first cousin marriages were a bad idea, although they'd happened a lot. So she persuaded Wilhelm to marry someone else, someone not as pretty and not as nice and not as bright as Ella. And Wilhelm never forgot his first love.
Do you think, Clara, that the course of European, indeed world history, could have changed if Wilhelm had actually married Ella? She might have been a good influence on him, no?
Oh, absolutely. The reason why I write about these people, first about Vicky, and now I'm writing about Ella and her little sister, Alex, who became Alexandra, the Empress of Russia. The reason I write about these people is that their family dynamics, their personalities, have a huge effect on European and thus world history from the late 19th century to the early 20th century. And many things would have been different if Prussian, Russian, and British royal families had married differently and done different things. And yet, if you follow the story, you see these women who have a lot of status but no agency, essentially. They're used slightly as chess pieces, get into very difficult situations. And the sad thing is the world does suffer, and it shows you that a hereditary monarchy is a very bad idea, to have too much power. And the Romanovs came crashing down because Alex did have a hemophiliac son, and there were disastrous consequences to that.
Yes. You're listening to Claire McHugh, who's an author, a novelist, and she's speaking to us from D.C., I think, today. Is it, Claire, you're in D.C.?
Yes, right. I live in Washington, D.C. now.
Mm-hmm. Washington, D.C. And Claire has published a novel called A Most English Princess about Queen Victoria's eldest daughter, and is now working on a novel about Ella, who was the princess that we discussed on Friday here on the show. Claire, I don't know about you, but I mean, I said this on Friday. I mean, if I was a Hollywood scriptwriter, I couldn't have made Ella's life up.
No. But I'm always fascinated when historical fiction writers decide to stray off the reservation and write things about historical characters that aren't true, because the truth is always the best story. It's almost unbelievable. And Ella, out of a great sense of responsibility and kindness, married a very difficult man, the Grand Duke Serge of the Romanov family, and from that a lot of other things happened.
Yeah, I mean, she not only did she marry into a dynasty, but at a moment in their history when, I mean, world history literally turned on both her and her daughter and her sister's actions or interactions with that dynasty. I mean, it's absolutely incredible that these two sisters were at the very heart of what turned into the Russian Revolution, and which we're still feeling the ramifications of today. I mean, with the two sisters, because I know a bit about Ellen, her sister in history has been given a slightly different view. I mean, how would you describe the personalities of those two sisters for the audience?
They're actually very contrasting. Ella is probably the stronger and more appealing of the two. The thing about Ella was that she was a person who sought faith. Her mother was a very serious Christian, brought up, of course, as an Anglican, and then living in Germany was a Lutheran, but was also interested in Catholicism, and she passed that on to her daughter. She died, and when Ella was 14, and Ella, you know, looked for the comfort of faith and knowledge through faith, and she, as you referred to, had many opportunities to marry various different people. In the end, she decided to marry Serge, who was not of the same religion. Of course, he had been brought up Russian Orthodox, but he too was a person who took faith very seriously. And she felt that with him, she would have a life of where piety would be respected, and where they would share an interest in living a life of virtue. Unfortunately, she was a very innocent young woman, and she didn't realize that Serge did have psychological problems. And in fact, it's thought that perhaps the marriage was never consummated. In fact, they did not have children. And she was she had made this self-sacrificing move to Russia. Of course, she enjoyed the Romanovs were the richest people basically in Europe at that time. So she enjoyed a great life of luxury, even as she was interested in helping the poor and things like that. But she was very lonely in Russia. And at her wedding, her little sister, then 12, had a little crush on Nikki, who was then the heir to the Russian throne, a boy of 16. And they had a little, you know, during the two weeks of the wedding celebrations, they got to know each other. And Ella, very lonely in Russia, fanned the flames of this romance against into the teeth of everybody's opposition. The queen, Victoria, the girl's grandparents, her grandmother was terribly afraid. The father was against it.
On the point about their marriage, Claire, between Sergei and Ella, because although they didn't have children, both appeared, at least in my research, to being, as you say, deeply religious. But also it could not be doubted that Ella loved her husband very, very deeply, both in an emotional and physical way, but also in a spiritual sense. I mean, there can be no question of that, surely.
No, there is no question. But it speaks, I think, we'll never know the truth, right? The letters were all burned by Serge asked when he died that all the letters be burned. But we'll never know the truth. But what we can tell from what Ella said and other people around them said, Ella, having made this commitment to Serge, believed that God, the Lord, had married them, and that it was up to, you know, she was responsible for trying to keep this marriage alive. And she loved Serge. She really did respect him in all sorts of ways. And I think, like a very compassionate person she was, she understood that the difficulties of his own youth and the challenges of his own nature made it hard for him to be what people might think of as an ideal husband. People often said, why do you let him criticize you like that? You know, she wasn't a modern person in that she didn't, self-actualization was not her goal. Her goal was to live a Christian life. And so having married this man, she took it seriously.
Absolutely. And she took it even more seriously after his death. I mean, just to let people know, I mean, Sergei was assassinated. And that proved to be an absolute turning point in her, not just her life, but very much her spiritual life, too.
Yes. There are many ways to pronounce his name, and I'm going with Serge because that's the one she often used. But Serge had became the governor of Moscow in 1895, and he and Ella lived in the Kremlin for 10 years until from 1895 until 1905, when an assassin threw a bomb into Serge's carriage, blowing him to pieces, literally, about 50 yards from where Ella was standing. And she ran out to pick up the pieces of his body, despite people saying, please stay away. But she was completely shattered by this experience, and she took it as a moment to change her life. She gave away all her vast wealth. She used the money she got for selling her jewelry to build a convent and an order of nursing sisters in the slums of Moscow, and a church as well. And then she set off to spend the rest of her life taking care of the poor and the injured during the war, the wounded soldiers. And it was there in the spring of 1917 that the Bolsheviks came to arrest her, despite the fact that all the people in Moscow said, leave her alone. She's just, you know, she's a nun now. She's helping people. She's not even a royal person anymore. But they did take her away and they did kill her.
You're listening to Claire McHugh, who's a novelist, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. today here on the Turley Frequency. Claire, are you able to stay for the next sequence and maybe take some questions
gladly.
From anybody? So if you want a question, or if you've got a question for Claire about Ella or about Vicky, the Victorian princess, or any kind of Victorian princesses and the various clashes with history, then now's your moment to call in. Alternatively, if you want to speak to Claire about writing a novel, you ever thought about writing a novel? No. Now's your moment to ask. 888-928-0881 or text me on 251-928-2111 and I'll be very, very grateful to field any questions for you. I'd be very interested when we come back after the break, Claire, to look a little bit about the legacy of Ella, because you alluded to the great tragedy that came into her life and then her subsequent martyrdom. I'm assuming that for many years this went underground as the Christianity went underground in Russia through the Soviet communists. But today there's a renaissance, and indeed in recent times she's been declared an Orthodox saint. Isn't that right?
Yes, that is right. And her statue is also outside of Westminster Abbey in the Martyrs of the 20th Century.
Okay, we're going to take this up when we come back after this. We'll continue to speak to Claire McHugh about Grand Duchess Elizabeth and her ongoing legacy. Back after these words. Stay with me. We've got a lady writer, but not on the TV. She's on the radio this morning. Claire McHugh's coming to us from Washington, D.C., the author of A Most English Princess, a novel of Queen Victoria's daughter. And Claire is currently writing a novel about the Grand Duchess Elizabeth, who we spoke about on Friday. Claire, welcome back to the Turley Frequency. We have a question from a listener, which asks, how did Ella react or act towards Rasputin? Now, before you answer that, Claire, I better just, for anybody out there who doesn't know who Rasputin was this rather strange figure that came from, I think, Siberia or thereabouts, and seemed to penetrate the Romanov court to disastrous effect and had a great influence, I believe, upon Ella's sister, who was also the empress. But you will tell us more, Claire. How did Ella react to this strange mystic?
I'm afraid that Ella, from the beginning, was suspicious of Rasputin. She did not recognize him as a holy figure the way that her sister did. And pretty much from the start, she urged Alexandra and Nicholas to keep a distance from him. And her warnings did fall on deaf ears. And in fact, the very painful last meeting between the sisters happened in December of 1916, when the rest of the family sent Ella to the Alexander Palace outside of St. Petersburg to beg her sister one more time to send Rasputin away. And the sister, Alexandra, sent Ella away saying, I never want to see you again. And they never did see each other again.
What do you make, Claire, of there's been an element of revisionism around Rasputin, which tends to downplay his role in the revolution. Do you think that's inaccurate?
I think it's inaccurate. A terrific historian who wrote a book on Rasputin, Doug Smith, says, and I agree, no Rasputin, no Lenin. The damage that Rasputin did to the monarchy was he became to epitomize everything that Russians hated, ordinary Russians hated about the regime. And the fact that the royal family again and again asked by various people, including the parliament, to send the man away, refused to, showed that that they were not at all responsive. It was possible for the Tsar, and the Tsar said, listen, Rasputin doesn't have that much influence. But in fact, he did have an influence. And when the Tsar went to live on the front, new political moves were made. People, important officers of the state were appointed and dismissed on Alexandra's say, and she was taking direction from Rasputin. So, I don't think Rasputin was the only thing that brought the revolution along, but it soured the relationship between the people and the Tsar and the Tsarina in a way that is almost incalculable.
Yes, and I think as well, Claire, there's something very tragic about those two figures, Rasputin and Ella, because Ella, very much a Christian mystic in the true sense, whereas whatever mysticism Rasputin was following, it was definitely led to chaos and destruction. So a fascinating sort of historic, it just shows how history is driven by personality. Would you agree as a historical fiction writer that ultimately it's all about personality?
Completely. I do love your distinction between Ella and Rasputin. It's true that Ella was had a mystical element to her faith, something that, not all of us might, respond to, but we could see that she lived a deeply Christian life, whereas Rasputin lived a deeply unchristian life and was a charlatan. His influence over the Tsarina was also one of, he got lucky. He urged her not to listen to the doctors when they were giving her son a lot of aspirin, which we now know was something that would have increased the bleeding. And he did bring calm to the family situation because she herself, Alexandra, was near hysteria all the time. But this does not make someone a religious person. Whereas Ella sought faith, good faith all her life, and then lived a life of amazing renunciation and also generosity toward people around her. She is a remarkable figure.
Do you think, she's a saint today, as you alluded to, in the Russian Orthodox Church. Do you think that, it's obviously her martyrdom, absolutely, but she martyrdom, as we know, even in the Catholic Church, we know that many martyrs are martyrs long before their life finishes. And would you say that her lifestyle prior to her martyrdom was one of sanctity?
She was a person of contradictions, like all of us. And the way that it manifested in her case was that, she was much admired for her beauty. It's a tough job for someone who's admired for their beauty not to enjoy it. And there was an element, especially as a young person, that she was probably, could be quite proud and quite vain. And she loved clothes and jewelry and things like that. And I think she took great pride in the fact that people thought of her not only as beautiful, but also as nice as could be. However, she struggled with that pride and tried to reconcile it with what she believed was required of living a Christian life. And as she aged, she became a more well-rounded and more full and spiritual person in a way that we could really admire. And the fact that she responded to her husband's death by saying also, let's not execute the murderer. Let's ask him, let's forgive him and let him live. And of course, no one paid any attention. They executed him within days. But it was interesting that she could at that age, that she was about 40 then, say that.
You're listening to Claire McHugh, author, novelist of A Most English Princess, a novel of Queen Victoria's Daughter, and currently working on another novel about Grand Duchess Elizabeth, who is today a saint in the Orthodox Church and a great Christian witness, regardless of that. I don't know if you've been, you touch on her beauty, which is remarkable, even comes across in the photographs, those rather sort of unbelievable photographs of her youth and as a princess in Europe, etc. But I find the photographs taken of her after her renunciation, even more striking. I don't know if you do, Claire. There's something in her face which is otherworldly.
Yes, you do see that. I think she looks very she's a very serious person after age about 30, and when she's wearing her habit, she looks she looks very serious. And she, you know, she has witnessed a lot. And one thing that she witnessed was the suffering of her little sister Alexandra, a very difficult person, not at all as well-rounded or thoughtful as her older sister. And she watched her little sister become really not an all effective empress. And I think she, who had so much to do with putting her in that place, I think did suffer some sense of, well, you know, I've done this and look at the consequences. It's interesting too that Ella is remembered in her own family. She is the great aunt of Prince Philip. She was the aunt of Prince Philip's mother, who also took up a nun's life in midlife. And, you know, Prince Philip was very proud of what Ella had accomplished and the kind of person that she was. And that was one of the reasons why when they put new statues into the exterior of Westminster Abbey in 1998, one of them was Bonhoeffer, one of them was Martin Luther King, and then another one was Ella.
Yes, thank you for reminding me of that, Claire, because I was aware of that, that if anybody visits London and Westminster Abbey, which is an ancient church in the center of London, today it's Anglican and it was Catholic for centuries, they put up, as Claire said, a number of modern martyrs, and there's and Grand Duchess Elizabeth is one of them. There's also Maximilian Kolbe there as well, I think, from memory, and a number of others, Christian witnesses throughout the... But just turning... a little bit away from Ella for a moment, Claire, because you're a historical fiction writer, and I've dipped my toe into that murky water as well, with also a real live individual or somebody who was real and live at one point. And there's an inevitable criticism when you use real historical figures in your fiction. You know, you can never please anybody. I'm sure you'll agree. You're either too much this way, too much the other way. How do you, as a writer, navigate that? I mean, what are the rules in your mind for using historical figures in something which is ultimately a work of your own imagination?
Everybody has their own rules of the road. I agree that I believe that some people break too many rules. So my rules of the road are the number one source I'm using are the letters of the people involved.
Right.
So and the number and number two, I never put people somewhere that they were not there at that time. I'm following Victorian people, you know enough about where they are any given moment in history. In March of 1884, where were these people? So I use the scaffolding of fact. Where were people? What were they saying about their lives? And I don't mix in fictional characters with the completely fictional characters with the characters that were flesh and blood. Only servants I make up because if I don't know who they are and I need a servant to move things something around, I'll put somebody in who I know don't know lived. So it's the where they were and what they said about their lives at that time. I stick within that. And then, you know, fiction is basically scenes. It's one scene after another, and then there's exposition in between. And the scenes are it's a proposition to the reader. This is what I believe these two people would have said to each other based on their circumstances, what happened later. And I also hope that my historical fiction is positioned as an effort to bring to life these people out of the archives. What might it feel to have felt to be them? And of course it's not, it's, as you say, it's a work of the imagination, but it is tailored to work within what we already know about them. And
right.
Hopefully,
So, Claire, in a way, it's almost like you're trying to help the reader to to as you say, enter into the inner world of the characters, even though your research no doubt is scrupulous so that everything is factually accurate, but you're trying to give it a kind of color and a taste, I guess. It's almost like a painting. You know, you can paint somebody, but you get there's a certain the artist gives it a certain feel, a certain is that akin to something you're doing? You're giving it a certain feel, a certain lens.
Well, it is, after all, fiction. It's an interpretation, because the one thing that you can't do, the letters, after all, are performances in themselves. But somebody's inner life, you have to guess. So I am painting in what I believe the emotional reality were for these characters. And it makes for, I like working with these kind of guardrails. And I also think people have forgotten how the personalities of very young women and men did so much to affect history that we live with. And so gives it freedom, excitement, right?
Yeah.
How did these decisions of very young people matter?
Absolutely. But tell me this, Claire, I mean, having done so much research, and I know your research includes actually visiting places that these historical figures lived in, moved in Germany or Russia or wherever. I mean, part of me would say, well, why don't you just write a biography? Wouldn't it be easier?
Because a good biography is very dry. Because in a biography, you cannot say, and then Ella thought, I'll do this because you don't know. And within a biography, I do like biographies, and I may indeed write biographies in the future. Journalism taught me a lot about writing, about what happens in people's lives. But having been very attracted to a great deal of historical fiction that's well done, Gore Vidal, Hilary Mantel, I see that it makes you think about a character in a way that may be deeper, or it's more intimate, right? It's a warmer experience than a biography. And also, it's a piece of entertainment. And the stories from the past are, I think, extremely entertaining, not only for what the acts that happened, it's also thinking about, wow, that thing, those decisions that were made in the 1880s and 1890s, we're still living with that. You know, the fingerprints of these peoples are still on the world. And for me, that gives it extra resonance.
You've been a journalist and an editor, and that. Were you always wanting to be a novelist? Was that what you always wanted to do in terms of writing?
I was a very enthusiastic reader, like many writers from the age of about 8 or 9 or 10. I remember figuring out that Laura Ingalls Wilder had actually written the Little House books about a character named Laura, and that must be her. But, you know, fiction is really tricky to do well. So for many years, I thought I was not capable of it. And then I thought, at the age of 55, when other work kind of dried up, well, if not now, when? So I gave it a try, and I was very happy that people seem to like my first book, and I hope others will even like the second. And it's a wonderful way of life, because it does marry my interest in reporting and archival work with colorful writing and expression.
Tell our audience, Claire, where they can find out more about you and your writing.
I have a website, like lots of people, claremchugh.com. It's Claire without an I, claremchugh.com. My book is A Most English Princess is available from HarperCollins, and my new book, which I believe is going to come out in January of 2024, called The Royal Princesses of Hesse, will also be available.
Okay.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's great. Thank you so
on.
Much for coming on the show today, Claire. When we come back after these words, we're going to pray the divine mercy, and you're invited to join us.
Happy day.